Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. Milan San Remo was run this past weekend, and they experienced a rather nasty event. Brought to their knees with snow, wind, bitter cold, the group started at 200 riders, dwindled down to 135, who had to be bussed to a location. They actually shortened the race, and they braved the elements to complete it, but it was brutal. Interestingly enough, the winner of the race, Gerald Chalik, can be even more proud of his efforts for his South African team, MTM Quebeca. The team promotes a charity that is changing the lives of thousands of impoverished South Africans, and all with the help of the, as they say, the humble bicycle. Quebeca is a South African voluntary organization set up to help the country's poorest rural communities, and one of the ways it does this is by providing a specially built bike to kids. The word Quebeca is Zulu for, quote, to move forward. And the charity slogan is mobilizing change in Africa, one bicycle at a time. What else was interesting about this team, Mountain Quebeca or MTN Quebeca, is that as a pro-continental team, it touts the first black South African rider, a young domestique named Songezo Jim, who said his hands were so cold he couldn't get his gloves off. But he finished the race, and it was just amazing that one of the comments that was made in some of the news about this race this week was that this team, the winning team, doesn't tout like, Nike or Pepsi or a bank, but is doing charity work. So that it all came together pretty well. I also saw three of the Peloton's top riders who have served their respective times in being banned for 6 months. They slipped back into the Peloton this week. Garmin Sharp's Tom Danielson, Christian Vandevelde, and Dave Zabriskie lined up for the Volta a Catalunya in Girona, Spain this week. Happy to be racing again after their six-month ban. I'm happy to see racing may actually begin to right itself. There is no time like the present. So I promise there won't be any more racing this week. We're going to move on with our show. We'll be talking about and wrapping up the National Bike Summit with two ladies down in Columbus, Ohio, Jody Zuranin, who has been on the show with us before, and Jeannie Martin. Both work for Consider Biking in Columbus. Jody's the organization's operation manager, comes from a financial background. And Jeannie, who's the VP and current acting director, has a long history in landscape, architecture, and urban bicycle infrastructure design. Jody once again headed up the Ohio delegation to the League of American Bicyclists Bike Summit and is going to walk us through some of her experiences in D.C., including the face-to-face that they had with Secretary LaHood, Secretary of Transportation LaHood. There's a really cool picture of the Ohio delegation with the secretary. She'll also tell us what transpired at the women's conference that took place the morning before the summit opened on Monday. Jeannie will also help define some of the nomenclature and directives that go to understanding the summit and its intended outcome. Then we're going to talk with a blogger by the name of Angie Schmidt. So it's an all-girl show this week. Angie works and writes for streetsblog.org, but she's right here in Cleveland, interestingly enough. Her boss, of course, is Ben Fried. He's out of New York, and we've talked to him on the show in the past. She's penned several articles in the past couple of weeks that just caught my attention. I thought, well, gee, I really need to talk to this girl. And then I found out she's here in Cleveland, so that was pretty easy. The first article was, Ohio puts the squeeze on people's right to walk. And I flagged it as just news originally until I saw her second article, which was how the U.S. tax code favors drivers over other modes. So I figured the time of year is close to tax time, April 15th, and it was a good time to discuss this topic. And then up popped her third interesting commentary, which was just this week, and it's about a new bikeway in Somerville, Massachusetts. So I'll be talking to her about that also. I'll wrap up the week's news, So let's get right to it and welcome Jody Zoranin and Jeannie Martin from Consider Biking in Columbus, Ohio to the show. Jody and Jeannie, the two J's, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much, Diana. Great to be here.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, I'm great. I'm really looking forward to wrapping up the Bike Summit with you guys because I wasn't able to go this year, unfortunately. But Jeannie, let's start with you because we haven't actually met and I haven't really spoken with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do at Consider Biking?
Absolutely. I am a landscape architect and own my own company and have a lot of expertise in traditional landscape architecture, but urban planning and a passion for cycling. So I was asked by Jeff Stevens, who is the former executive director of Consider Biking, to join and serve on the board of directors. And shortly after he left, I ended up getting heavily involved, along with Brian Haggerty, who also started about the same time I did on the board of directors. And the two of us were asked to move to the executive board. And at that point, I was made the vice president and acting executive director, and Brian Haggerty is the new president. And then we also have another secretary, Andrew Seitzinger, who's new as well to the executive board. So we had quite a bit of change over the last, I would say, about a year. But we've been making great strides, so I'm pretty active and pretty embedded in Consider Biking.
Well, and I mean, I know Jeff, and I know he moved on to something else, and I knew that Consider Biking was a little bit of flux, but it sounds like it's settling down now. Jody, has your role at Consider Biking changed since I last saw you?
Well, the role itself hasn't changed much, but as, you know, Jeannie mentioned, the management structure around me has shifted, and I was just going to say this is my third year coordinating the Hill visits. So, you know, each year has gotten a little easier. And even with a whole new Congress this year, I still felt better. So, you know, the job itself brings new challenges. And I guess I did want to give you a little update that since we last talked, I have become a league cycling instructor. And I'm also a Greater Columbus Certified Tourism Ambassador. So
nice. Yeah, well, Columbus is doing some really, really nice things with cycling. I know Cleveland is starting to move along too, but Consider Biking has its fingers in a lot of very cool pies down there. So let's talk about the Bike Summit, since I wasn't able to go this year, and it seemed like it was an exciting year and kind of a different year because of all of the changes in legislation over the last year. Our delegation, the Ohio delegation, were 11 members. Were most of the districts represented?
Not as many as we've had in the past. We had 5 of those 11 were from Consider Biking. We had 3 that were from Bike Cleveland and 2 in the Dayton area.
Mm-hmm.
So we were representing so the 2 from the Dayton were representing Ohio Bicycle Federation and the Huffy Corporation. So we had one other individual who came from the Covington, Kentucky area, across the river from Cincinnati. So we didn't have as many as the year prior, but then again, we weren't really pushing the transportation bill as much as we needed to have the push as last year.
That's true. And I understand there were about 720 delegates from all over the country?
Yes.
Okay.
So going into the trip, we had scheduled meetings with 2 of the senators and 9 of the 16 representatives. And we may drop in visits to the remaining 7. Of course, we had a wonderful snowstorm that was
oh, that's right.
From the Capitol.
I forgot. Everybody was tweeting about this snowstorm that was killing the Capitol. But did it really? I thought it really snowed more outside the Capitol.
No, it rained. We had big fluffy flakes from time to time, but really all it was rain. And it was to the point where, in some respects, it was good because since everything was such an upheaval, we were able to personally meet with Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, that's here in Columbus. We weren't able to meet with Portman, but we did stop by. And when we stopped by, we were able to run into Secretary LaHood and got a picture of him with him.
That's very cool. I saw that. That's really nice. Really nice.
So in some respects, it was, even though it wasn't, it was kind of a day that turned upside down, all of our representatives that we met with in D.C. that were from Ohio were extremely wonderful with us. They were almost to the point of being apologetic for the federal government shutting down for some rain. So in some respects, it was kind of nice because we had that chuckle of, you know, back home we know how to handle this stuff. So.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Jeannie, right. Before we get to the actual sessions at the Bike Summit that I do want to discuss, you seem to have a good handle on the MAP 21 issue. Can you define MAP 21? It's really important to move on with the information we're going to talk about this evening.
Exactly, exactly. So the MAP 21 is a new transportation bill that Congress combined some previous programs that were dedicated to biking and walking and put them into one. And so it went from being what we call transportation enhancements, or TE funds, into transportation alternatives, or TA funds. And what's important about this is that this program, we also had to take a significant cut in funding, but it's also only a two-year program. So we're going to be busy next year lobbying for more transportation, but we're trying to maximize the investments that we can get from biking and walking underneath MAP 21's new program, and then also just with the larger core of transportation and safety funds. So our strategy is still to try to get the state DOTs and the MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, to fully fund staff and implement the new transportation alternatives, fully maximize the state's investments in safe and accessible streets, and to fully spend the remaining funds from the transportation enhancements, safe routes to school, and recreational trail programs. So each year we have to ask for the governor to support the recreational trails program in the fall, so that's a big push, because they're allowed to opt out of that. And then the Safe Routes to School program was kind of rolled into the transportation alternative. So we've got a smaller pot of money to work with, and that's what we're kind of talking about. That's what makes this a big deal.
Okay. Well, Jody, one of the things I want to focus on now that MAP 21 is sort of laid out and we know where the dollars kind of are, was a session at the summit that was titled, What Do They Think? Perceptions of Biking on Capitol Hill. It was presented by a guy named Douglas Meyer, who's a consultant at Bernuth and Williamson. And it seems that it conveyed a message that was very interesting and a little bit different from what we've heard in the past. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was eye-opening that, the big message is that biking is not a fringe movement, you know. Advocates no longer have to try to convince the legislators that it's a legitimate mode of transportation. So, hey, you know, our work is done, apparently.
but not
well,
really.
Well, and that's the thing. Lawmakers now view bicycling, their view has shifted from a middle-aged man wearing Lycra to, you know, a working woman heading to her job on a bike share. So, you know, a lot of this has just shifted around them, and they've said that this is the bike share itself has really changed the summit, because you don't have to try to convince people that the people will ride the bikes if you make them available. So,
well, DC's bike share just seems to be going gangbusters. I know you took a tour, I think, of the bike share facility while you were there too, right?
Yes,
both of us did.
Oh, cool. So one of the statements that Doug Meyer made was, advocates need to recognize the pressures on the federal budget, and instead of relying on the dedicated funding, focus on how to access the money that's there. And so is there money? I mean, is there money that's just languishing somewhere and isn't being tapped?
Well, you know, let's just say that the landscape is really shifted since this new bill came into law on October 1st. And as Jeannie said, it's a two-year bill, and several programs are folded under transportation alternatives. And I like to look at it as, you know, I guess the good thing is that now there's more flexible uses where, you know, before it all had to sort of fit one program. So it seems like we might see more cross-purposes. We've been assured that there's no, especially with Safe Routes to School, there's no uncommitted safety lieu funds. And so, you know, we've been told that these have been fully committed. You know, sometimes it takes a while to disperse them. But and maybe some of those, I'm thinking maybe those are some other states that might have, you know, untapped funds. And then the other thing we wanted to say with MAP 21, you know, the largest source is still transportation alternatives for, bike and pedestrian projects. But as Jeannie mentioned, you know, highway safety improvement programs, congestion mitigation, air quality is being used for bike shares here and there, and so surface transportation programs. I think the big thing about this bill is that now there's more options, more flexibility, but as advocates, it gives us more places to look to say, hey, you know, this project would qualify and meet our needs. So we have to get creative.
We're speaking with Jody Zuranin and Jeannie Martin from Consider Biking in Columbus, Ohio, and we're talking about the National Bike Summit that was just a couple of weeks ago down in Washington, D.C., in what they thought was bad weather. They should only know about bad weather down there. So, really. So,
It's not us, the D.C. they.
That's, I know, that is the D.C. they. That's exactly right. So, some of the people who have been really big advocates for cycling and pedestrian issues are people like Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, even in our state, Stephen LaTourette, and they have decided either not to run again or to step down at this point. Was there talk about how to continue the momentum with legislators on our issues? Are there new people stepping up and saying, you know, I'll kind of fill in on that role?
To me, the attitude seemed to be that even, you know, it's imminent that Ray LaHood is stepping down. And the keynote speech was kind of a, you know, a send-off to him. They, in New York City, Jeanette City Khan presented him with a street sign that said LaHood's Way. And it was very touching. So, but I hear what you're saying. He's been very supportive of, you know, bicycling as transportation, and we don't want to lose that progress. But for me, my opinion is that, you know, the sea change has occurred under his leadership, and that will continue at the transportation department. That's my hope. You know, bicycling is recognized as a legitimate form of transportation. That part isn't going to change. And so, now, Diane, were you at the summit when he stood on the table?
You know what? I wasn't there. I wasn't at that. I was at that summit, but for some reason, I didn't see him do it.
Okay.
I don't know where the heck I was.
Right?
Yeah.
So he said, I can guarantee you the next secretary will, you know, will not do that.
But will not stand up on the table and address the crowd. Yeah. He's such a cool guy. And I guess he made an announcement about a safety summit he wants to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good. And we're trying to get him to bring it to Columbus.
Oh, I told him Cleveland. Whatever. Ohio would be awesome. Do you think the summit this year was a success?
Absolutely.
Yes. And I, you know, that's, I feel one of the biggest wins was, you know, when from that Doug Meyer report, he said cyclists can stop begging for a seat at the table. It's time to sit down. You know, we've arrived. What do you say, Jeannie?
I say that one of the impressive things I felt from the summit was that they are actually showing quantifiable data on the economic benefits, which is, I think, when you were asking that question as far as is there a change in perception in D.C. about things, I would say yes, because we're able to start showing the economic benefits, that there's an actual bottom dollar amount that you can put to providing these amenities that improves the quality of life and improves the property values. And at that point, we have those Republicans who have been against this that all of a sudden are saying, okay, we can increase the dollar value, we can increase the income tax, we can increase our tax base in our communities by doing this. And that's what's been extremely helpful.
Yeah, well, and then there are jobs. You know, building bike infrastructure also offers jobs.
Yep.
So that's very cool. So did you two go to different breakout sessions?
Yes.
What breakout session, Jeannie, did you go to that you really got something out of?
Well, because of what I do for a living during my day job, as far as being a landscape architect,
right,
the sessions that I went to were the Bicycling Means Business sessions. So they had two that were back-to-back. They had one that was getting the facts straight and another one called helping developers meet the triple bottom line. And that's where they were starting to present studies that were done that were showing the economic benefits of providing bicycle and pedestrian facilities, how just increasing your walkability score by 1 point can increase property values anywhere from $700 to $3,000.
Wow.
So they're sitting there showing things that can happen and how they've been studying this stuff over the last year and a half, and showing actual dollar amounts. So that helps me with any presentations that I'm going to try to do, as far as saying when I'm going and meeting with developers or speaking with council members or anything on any of my projects, that I can say, hey, look, by doing this, it's not, as Jody had said, it's not just the people that are in spandex. You're actually providing for our younger generations, which have purposely chose not to have cars, and they want to stay in these areas, and they're getting the high-paying jobs, and this is what they want. And now we can increase the property value, we can increase our tax base, and jobs, as you kept saying, which is what's important.
Well, as I remember going to those sessions, you could take away a lot of really interesting bullet points that you can bring up in all kinds of situations that you might find yourself in when promoting cycling. So, Jody, which session did you find the most interesting from your perspective?
Well, and I say it's kind of the extras, because, you know, there was an excellent presentation that they offered on the Green Lanes project. So the pilot cities, a couple of them presented, and, you know, the stories they told about Memphis, from going from one of the most dangerous cities to bike in, you know, almost a complete 180, and they have this dramatic plan to you know, put bike lanes in place in Memphis, and so that was very inspiring. And then the other one I really enjoyed was we toured the Capital Bike Share Operations Center. So to see how a 1,500 bike system, you know, the behind the scenes was, it was eye-opening, enjoyable. Yeah, I like that.
Is Columbus getting ready to launch a bike share?
We are getting ready to launch a bike share.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
We had Alta Bike Sharing has been selected as our bike share provider. And rumor has it that we should have a launch date at the end of July. So we're very excited. Things are moving forward.
That's really, really great. Really great. So, Jody, we only have a few minutes left, and I would like to talk about the Women's Conference. It occurred on the day before the summit, and I know that you only attended the morning session. I've read a lot about it. Tell me what you got out of the Women's Conference.
Well, an overall impression was, you know, the shift from Monday to Monday night in the gender mix, you know, that there was 350 during the day and it was 95% female, and then, you know, about 750 that night, and it seemed, you know, the opposite, 95% male. But good to see everybody coming out there. The highlight of my week was Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, who was she actually was she's an Iraqi war veteran and a double amputee from a combat accident. And she rides a special hand-crank bicycle. She's done marathons. She's even used it in her campaign to show her constituents, you know, I'm willing to go the extra mile. So,
wow.
Yeah. She
inspiring.
You know, and she's out there living fully, no excuses. So that, to me, was definitely the highlight of the Women's Conference and probably the whole week.
So let me ask you something about this gender gap. This 350 women showed up in the morning session, and then for the evening keynote or the opening of the actual summit, there were 720 delegates and mostly men. Where did all those women go? Did they not come to the summit?
Well, a woman I met was from Pittsburgh, and she just came in for the day and was headed back. So, you know, maybe, you know, I had the same question. If the numbers only doubled, shouldn't the gender balance have stayed a little bit more balanced? But
interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, and this is sort of one of those, I'm going to throw it out there. I'm wondering if women are segregating themselves for a reason. It says Women's Conference. I don't know how comfortable a man would be to come to the Women's Conference. I mean, I'm sure there were a few men there, but
yes. The
summit itself is open to everybody. So it's interesting to me that more women didn't stay, perhaps, for the summit itself, you know, and get whatever it is they would get out of that. Well, so wrap up the summit for me, Jeannie, for you.
I will say this is the first year that I've been to it, and I will definitely be back next year. I was very impressed, very pleased, and really enjoyed myself. And being able to learn the economic side for what I do was fantastic. And I've always been up on the hill advocating for my professional organization, so I love Advocacy Day on the Hill, so you can ask me back anytime for that.
Yeah, it's fun. It's actually a lot of fun, and everybody loves to see you. Everybody's always nice. Jody, wrap it up for me.
Well, yes, we love to wear those little neon pins. Everybody loves them. But, you know, I think one of the impressions that I really had was how New York City is measuring sales tax for, as they put in the bike and walkability areas. And it's like, you know, that gives us the piece that we need to show that there's an economic impact to what we do. So onward and upward.
Yep. And so if you get the safety summit, I'll be jealous, but I'll come.
Oh, good.
And I know
you have, to have you
have one more thing to say. You've got something coming up down there.
We do. And it's funny that you mentioned that whole, what do women feel like? We have the first ever Ohio Women's Bicycling Summit. It's going to be held on May 10th at Goodale Park Shelter House from about 10 until 4. We have Representative Teresa Fetter speaking, along with First Lady Karen Kasich is also going to be speaking towards the end of the day. So we have 5 sessions that are going to be covering all sorts of the myths and barriers that tend to probably make the interested but concerned not cross the boundaries for women. So this is a women specifically summit only. This is going to be the first of its kind. We're very, very excited.
And how can we find out about that for those who are interested in attending?
We have a webpage, which is ohiowbs.org.
Okay. I'll get that up on our Facebook page. Well, Jody and Jeannie, thank you so much for wrapping up your experience of the Bike Summit this year. I will look forward to seeing you. Maybe I'll drive down for the Women's Summit. That's not a bad idea.
Oh, great.
I would like to do that. All right. Have a great night.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Bye-bye. Jody Zoranin and Jeannie Martin joined us from their respective homes in Columbus, Ohio. They are with Consider Biking, which is the advocacy group down in Columbus. We're going to take a short break, and I'll be right back with some news.
Psst, Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm Diane Lees, and I'm back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and I've got some news before we meet up with Angie Schmidt at the end of the show this evening. I spent a really nice afternoon having lunch with my sister this week. We got to talking about the show and about cycling, and I was surprised to find that she's very adamant about not allowing her 2 grandchildren, ages 12 and 5, to ride bicycles. So she asked me if I could help her understand how to overcome those feelings when she and I both grew up with the freedom and desire to get on our bikes early in the mornings and ride as far and as long as we wanted when we weren't in school, of course. So I wasn't sure what to say to her, especially in light of the fact that I don't have grandchildren or young children. And even while I know that riding is not inherently dangerous for kids, I know that parents, and in this case grandparents, truly believe that it is. So I was very pleased to come across an article from Momentum magazine titled Women Only Rides. And I'm thinking maybe this kind of thinking will help her to change her mind and some other women too. Here's a snippet from the article. Women only group rides provide an environment meant to empower and encourage, not intimidate. Women only rides make a welcoming and non-competitive space for newbie and veteran cyclists to come together, said Heidi Hashimoto, who's the organizer of the Cupcake Rides in Toronto, Ontario. These rides have the power to inspire women to contribute to creating livable and vibrant communities and cities. And my favorite experience, recalls Rebecca Cerna, executive director of the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, while discussing the local Heels on Wheels rides, is seeing women who never have done a group ride and often have never ridden on the street experience city cycling for the first time. A growing focus of many women-only rides is to make them even more inclusive. We are seeing many more women on bikes, said Cerna. Now we need to make sure that women in communities of color feel welcome and able to bring their talent, style, and interests to the cycling experience. So there are rides, two wheels and heels events in Columbus and Cleveland, Ohio, and Chicago, Illinois, cupcake rides in Toronto, Ontario, and heels on wheels in Atlanta. And I imagine there'll be a lot more rides that are inclusive for women. And where women go, their kids go. So I think a lot of people are bringing their kids too. So another topic that seems to be really hot right now is women of color and riding. And it was evidently that so in 1928. From the League of American Bicyclists this week comes an article: while working on her dissertation on the social history of blacks in D.C., Maria McCorter came upon an article about five black women who biked from New York City to Washington, D.C. in 1928. McCorter writes, decades before AIDS rides, critical mass, tweed rides, and more, five women embarked on a group ride from New York City to Washington, D.C. during Easter weekend in 1928. These five New Yorkers, Mary Lou Jackson, Velma Jackson, Ethel Miller, Leola Nelson, and Constance White, biked 250 miles over 3 days. On the first day of their ride, they biked 110 miles to Philadelphia. The second day, they biked 40 miles to Wilmington, Delaware. And the third and final day, they biked more than 100 miles, arriving in Washington, D.C. around 9 p.m. Once in D.C., they did some sightseeing around the National Mall and Howard University. They also took time to have the photograph that was shown in this article taken. And she notes that they sit so confidently on their bicycles, resplendent in their leather jackets, caps, bloomers, and stylish socks. When asked what motivated them to embark on the group ride, they responded that they were motivated by, quote, the love of the great outdoors that each of them cherished. Interestingly, they also challenged other young women 21 years old and older to replicate their trip in less time. So I thought that that was kind of interesting. And moving on, there is still more mention of women in color in cycling. And one of the sessions at the Women's Conference preceding the Bike Summit earlier this month was delivered by Jenna Burton. Jenner's organization, Red, Bike, and Green, wants to shift the color balance in bicycling. And in an article written by Isa Hopkins on grist.org said, if I asked you to picture a prototypical cyclist, you'd probably conjure up an image of a lean white guy rocking a snug spandex Lycra blend racing suit. It's exactly the sort of image that inspired Jenna Burton to create Red, Bike, and Green, a group that sets out to break the stereotype and get more African Americans riding bicycles. It was 2007, and Burton, a Connecticut native and graduate of Howard University, a historically black college in Washington, D.C., had moved to Oakland, drawn to the city's history, diversity, and activist culture. Although she hadn't been on a bike since she was 9 years old, Burton was inspired by the cyclists she saw hitting the streets each day, so she decided to join them. Being a recent grad, I wasn't making a lot of money, she said. It was nice not to have to worry about gas or car payments. In this region where the culture is already there, I didn't feel like the oddball riding the bike. It goes on to talk about the group that she set up, Red, Bike, and Green, and how the ride draws anywhere from 20 to 50 participants each Friday. So the first Friday rides draw young, hip, and more able riders, but she developed a family-friendly ride on Saturdays where folks show up with kids, grandparents, and dogs. If you're anywhere in Oakland, it sounds like a lot of fun to try one of her Red, Bike, and Green rides. And evidently, local chapters have kind of popped up in Chicago and Atlanta. Very, very cool. This is from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. The Tour de Fat. Now, I'm not sure why Bicycle Retailer actually published this, but I thought it was interesting. Tour de Fat will roll through 12 cities. I think they're missing a really good one without Cleveland because, well, we won't go there. Fort Collins, Colorado, now in its 14th year, New Belgium Brewing's Tour de Fat Bikes and Beers Festival will visit a dozen cities in 2013. It celebrates the bicycle, showcases New Belgian beers, provides eclectic and engaging entertainment for all. The event is free, but all proceeds from food and beer go to local biking groups. Tour de Fat has raised a total of more than $2 million for nonprofit organizations. Tour de Fat brings together entire communities to celebrate the bike as a vehicle for social change and good time fun, said Matt Cowell, New Belgium Brewing's Tour de Fat impresario. This is a chance to see world-class entertainment in your own backyard with a beer in hand while you raise money for biking advocacy. It's a win-win-win. Dates and locations, well, May 11th, Atlanta, June 1st, D.C., June 15th, Durham, North Carolina, June 22nd, Nashville, July 13th, Chicago, July 27th, Minneapolis, August 17th, Boise, August 31st, Fort Collins, September 7th, Denver, September 21st, San Francisco, September 28th, San Diego, and October 5th, Tempe. See, there's no Cleveland. It should have a Cleveland. Tour de Fat, come on. It's just a natural here, I think. So anyway, this is not a wonderful piece, but maybe somebody out there can help. If you listen to the show in the Griffith Park area of LA, maybe you can help here. Regardless, it's a really hard story for me to report. It comes from the LA Times on March 20th, which was earlier this week. Police are still searching for a hit-and-run driver who struck a cyclist last month near Griffith Park, causing him to lose his leg. Damien Kevitt, 36, is speaking out about the accident that changed his life forever. He was cycling with his wife along the LA River on February 17th when they decided to head to Griffith Park. They were riding westbound on Zoo Drive toward the 5 freeway when a minivan that was stopped in traffic made a sudden left turn and struck Kevitt, according to the California Highway Patrol. Kevitt fell to the ground and became lodged underneath the vehicle, unconscious and unable to free himself. The driver allegedly accelerated and dragged Kevitt 600 feet until he fell from the minivan, California Highway Patrol says. The driver never stopped and continued traveling southbound on the 5 freeway, authorities said. In addition to losing one of his legs below the knees, Kevitt suffered numerous broken bones and severe road rash on his chest and back. The minivan is described as an older gray Toyota Sienna, which had a for sale sign posted in the rear window. There is a $25,000 reward being offered by the California Highway Patrol to find the hit-and-run driver, and anyone with information is asked to contact CHP. Not nice, not nice. So this is a nice one. We're going to end with a nice one. This comes from Cheryl Connor in Annapolis, Maryland, for ABC Channel 2 News in Baltimore. It's a story about a man whose hearing was restored by a cochlear implant and who hopes to raise money riding cross-country to make others benefit, as he did. Jacob Landis takes his cue from his trainer. Those verbal commands are helping his body prepare for the ride of a lifetime. At 23, Jacob has the life experience to know what it was like to be deaf. He said he was angry, depressed, and distracted. It wasn't a problem I was born with. It was something I had to watch being taken away from me. His hearing was taken away in the fourth grade. That summer, doctors put in a cochlear implant, which restored his hearing and gave him a new life. It's the difference between speaking and not speaking. It's the difference between hearing music and not hearing music, said Landis. The music on this Saturday morning is the panting and deep breaths, people taking on a boot camp to help the Annapolis native with one strong commitment. He started conditioning his body in January. In a few weeks, he'll start a six-month journey. Major League Baseball will play a major role in Jacob's ride. He plans to hit all 30 stadiums coming to Camden Yards on April 6th. The Orioles, his favorite team, has already donated tickets, getting him a step closer to his million-dollar goal. $1 million raised, along with the promise of grant money, will allow Jacob to donate about 100 cochlear implants to the Gift of Hearing Foundation. So far, Jacob has raised $12,000. His journey starts April 3rd and ends in September. His family will trail behind him in a van. It's www.jacobsride.com. So if he hears this, which he can, good luck. And off you go in a couple of weeks. That's the end of the news. We're going to shoot right on over to the west side of Cleveland and catch up with Angie Smith from Streets Blog. Angie, thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to actually talk to a writer from Cleveland and somebody with the Streets Blog Network. That's very cool. Are you from here?
No, actually, I grew up in Columbus, and I've been living in Cleveland about 4 years. I came to Cleveland to go to grad school. I studied urban planning at Cleveland State.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And now I live in Detroit Shoreway.
And so you like it here?
For the most part, yeah. I have my frustrations a little bit with Cleveland, but Yeah, overall it's been pretty good.
Well, we all do right now with the weather. It's pretty nasty.
That's a great example.
It is a good example. So are you a bicycle commuter?
The truth is I telecommute to New York for work, so not technically, but I'm a big cyclist, a big transportation cyclist. I live sort of a car-light lifestyle, and so I mostly leave my car in the driveway and do a lot of walking, biking, and transit riding, and it's really nice. And that's one of the things I like a lot about living on the near west side of Cleveland. It's pretty hospitable to that kind of lifestyle.
What are you in, the like Ohio City, Tremont area?
Yeah, like I said, Detroit Shoreway.
Oh, okay, so yeah, you did say that.
There.
Yeah, that's a nice area. That's kind of coming up in the world, too, huh?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I'm just about a half mile from the Red Line, so I can get to the airport on that, to downtown, to the art museum, really conveniently. It's really a great neighborhood for people that aren't interested in spending a lot of time in their car, like me.
Right. So you work with Ben Fried, evidently, out at Streets Blog in New York?
Right. He's my boss.
Okay.
Right.
And so how'd you get involved with Streets Blog?
Well, I run a blog in my personal time called Rustwire, where I started it in grad school, and I had been writing about urban issues across the industrial Midwest. And we became part of the Streets Blog Network, and that's what I now manage. Streets Blog Network is a consortium of about 400 livable streets and livable cities blogs around the world and around the United States. So every day now I go through a bunch of blog posts from all over the country and in different countries and try to dig up some of the more interesting and pertinent news for advocates everywhere. So originally I was one of those blogs, and they sort of became familiar with my work that way. And then they were hiring, and I applied, and that's sort of how it happened.
Well, what attracted me to your work are three articles that have just popped up 1, 2, 3 this week for me. And I'd like to explore them because they're very pertinent to the subject of cycling on a lot of levels. And some of them, unfortunately, have to do with pedestrian deaths. And you have an article that's interesting relative to that, of what's happening in Ohio. But I think it's probably happening other places, too. 115 pedestrians were killed on Ohio roads last year. And now there's a new law that clearly puts pedestrians at more risk in intersections. And that's what brought me to you. Explain that new law and how that might impact those crossing the streets at legal intersections.
Right. This has actually been in place for about 6 months in Ohio, but it wasn't brought to my attention until recently. A woman in Columbus is circulating a petition right now, trying to get the Ohio legislature to change the rules back to what they were before. So until about 6 months ago, the rules said, and it's kind of the rules most of us are familiar with, if you're a pedestrian and the walk sign says walk and you're in a crosswalk, you have the right of way. It's sort of the way we understand it. And that's the way it was. But they've altered the law a little bit. And now pedestrians are supposed to wait for the intersection to clear, even if they have the walk signal. And another rule they changed is pedestrians don't have the right-of-way at the beginning of the walk signal for cars turning right or left on red. So they've rolled back sort of pedestrian right-of-way in crosswalks on the walk signal, which I was sort of shocked to hear.
Well, I actually watched a video this week. I think it was shot in Miami. And it was set to music, and I think it was Rodney Dangerfield coming in and saying, I don't get no respect. But it was exactly what you're talking about. The walk sign was clearly walk for the pedestrians, and cars were paying virtually no attention to it.
Right. I think all of us that do some walking end up in a position a lot of times where we end up being maybe a little bit bullied by cars, just because they're so much larger and we really sort of are at their mercy as pedestrians. So I think there's definitely room for this law to be taken advantage of. And one concern that people like me who are concerned about this law have is that if a pedestrian is struck by a car and killed or injured badly, the pedestrian could be found at fault, or, you know, there could be no fault. And I've seen that happen. If these laws, the way the laws are written, they can have bad equity outcomes for pedestrians. And pedestrians are much more likely to be poor, elderly, or a minority than the general population. So I just wanted to make that point, that there's some sort of equity issues inherent in laws like this.
And I can certainly see that. So I can also see where cyclists can be impacted if they wait at intersections and then tend to cross with the crosswalk. So there's a possibility there, especially for urban cyclists, commuters, even though they may normally flow with traffic. I know a lot use crosswalks too. So I want to move on to your next blog topic, which I thought was fascinating, and the first one that actually struck me, and that is about how the federal tax laws impact commuters negatively as opposed to automobile owners. That how are we as commuters on bikes or pedestrians getting the shaft with the tax code?
Right. Yeah, that was based on an analysis done by the Tri-State Transportation Campaign in New York. And they basically tallied all the tax breaks that are available for people that drive to work, for people that take transit to work, and for people that bike to work. And it's quite a bit stacked towards drivers. The biggest one is drivers are eligible for up to $240 a month of they can write off that amount of money for parking. And just this year, just at the beginning of this year, they made that write-off available to transit riders. They equalized amounts. So if you spend $240 a month on transit tickets, you can buy those with pre-tax money, just like you could if you were buying parking. But that wasn't the case until this year, and that rule will expire at the end of this year. So we've really had to fight just to have parity in a lot of cases on these tax incentives.
But it doesn't apply to somebody who's riding a bicycle. There is the federal program that you can go to your employer and get a $20 voucher to go have repairs
right.
made to your bike or get tubes or something like that for repairs. But that $245 per month is not available to a cyclist who rides his or her bike to work every day.
That's right. In the European Union, they're actually talking about providing special tax credits and benefits to cyclists to try and promote that behavior, because cycling is so sort of socially healthy for the community. It makes people, you know, less obese, and it makes the air cleaner. So they're really trying to hold out a carrot for people to do that. And in the United States, we're doing the exact opposite, and that's the concern. The United States government is really sort of incentivizing people to drive in a lot of cases.
We're speaking with Angie Schmidt. She's right here in my town in Cleveland, and she is a blogger for streetsblog.org, and she has a blog called rustwire.com.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So the last article that caught my attention, but of course by no means limits your scope of topics, because you really do discuss a lot of things. I was looking at the stuff that's just you've done in March, and it's just amazing. Is something that's happening in Boston. The title of the blog was "Will Vehicular Cyclists and the Right to Park Trump Safer Streets in Boston?" So it seems that a protected bike lane is beginning to catch on in Boston and elsewhere. So what is happening there, and why might we be both interested and excited about it as urban cyclists?
Sure. Boston, an area of Boston called Somerville, which is sort of like an inner ring suburb. I guess that's not how you'd describe it technically in Boston. Very urban area. They have a plan, it's a preliminary plan, to put in a protected bike lane, so a cycle track, sort of, that will provide some additional protection to cyclists along a route that is very heavily trafficked and also a safety concern. Somebody told me it's the most heavily trafficked bicycle commuter route in the state of Massachusetts.
Are there any numbers that go with that, or do you have any idea of how many people per day might ride their bike on that particular road in Somerville?
I'm sorry, I don't. I have a feeling it might be pretty large. It's pretty close to Cambridge.
Okay.
With the Harvard and MIT, a lot of colleges, and but I can't say
okay. Exactly.
Well,
they're supposed to lose 100 parking spaces. So is there a pushback about this? I'm sure somebody's going, oh, no, we don't want to do this.
Right. There has been. And a lot of cycling advocates in Boston are concerned that the project could be in jeopardy at this point. There's only about 100 parking spaces that are going to be lost. And a study done by the city showed that that would not really impact people's ability to park too much, that there's sort of an excess amount of parking on that road. But still, I think parking, you know, we see this in city after city, and a lot of cities, they've been through these battles and have resolved them and sort of moved on to other issues. But when we have sort of these more suburb-type areas, Somerville has never had a protected bike lane, so they're sort of going through this controversy for the first time. And it will be interesting to see if the politicians there are willing to stand up to that kind of pressure and promote safe cycling.
So if there is a protected bike lane, will people be mandated to use it? Can they still ride in the streets? I know that there is controversy among cycling enthusiasts and cycling professionals who are saying, well, we really want to integrate bicycles into traffic. And then I know more women and women with children and commuters are happy to have a protected bike lane. You know, John Allen, you mentioned him in that piece, and I know he's not convinced that dedicated bike paths are a good way to integrate cyclists with motorists. What's happening with that?
Yeah, there's been a handful of vehicular cyclists that have opposed the project, and it's sort of given the city of Somerville room or certain politicians to say the cycling community isn't united behind this project. And that's a problem in a lot of cities that we've seen before. So that's not very uncommon. At Streets Blog and a lot of national bike advocacy organizations are really moving away from that philosophy. We've seen cities like New York add 250 miles of bike ways over the last 5 years and double the amount of cyclists on the street, and their streets have become a lot safer. There's a lot of evidence to support that. So our opinion at Streets Blog and among a lot of national bike advocacy groups is moving away from that philosophy. That vehicular cycling philosophy was it started in the 70s, and it had been kind of the predominant philosophy, especially among a lot of engineers over the last few decades. But during that time, we didn't see growth in cycling the way they did in European countries that really embraced separated infrastructure for cyclists. And so we still have cycle commuting rates that are less than 1% nationally, where in a place like Amsterdam, it's almost a majority.
Right. So, and you're saying that having the protected bike lanes and the protected bikeways are encouraging people to ride as opposed to being forced to ride in the street, even with better cycling and handling skills.
Right. I think there's a certain percentage of people that there have been studies done about this, and they're called fearless, confident. I can't remember. Fearless. There's a way that they're categorized. There's only about there's a very small percentage of people that are very confident, are comfortable riding in, you know, heavy traffic. And I think a lot of these vehicular cyclists, they fall into that category. And I think, to tell you the truth, that a lot of them are happen to be middle-aged men who are most confident sort of putting themselves in that position. But it doesn't work as well. And this is what a lot of national advocacy groups have sort of rallied around. It doesn't work as well if you're a child or if you're elderly, necessarily. You might not be able to ride fast enough to keep up in traffic, or even for women. I'm a very athletic woman, I consider myself, and I'm only about 30, so I'm sort of at the peak of my physical abilities. But I really don't, and even though I've been biking on the street for 10 years, I really don't feel comfortable taking the lane continuously on my commute. In certain situations, at intersections, I do. But I think, you know, there's a real sort of confidence game for people, and it does. What we think is it prevents new entrants to cycling, and it makes it sort of an elite activity instead of something, an everyday activity that anyone can get involved with.
And I can certainly see that perspective. Knowing Cleveland streets especially, you have to be somewhat brave to deal with especially cars going down places like Chester or Carnegie or some of the more congested east-west routes during rush hour, for example.
Right. It's sort of controversial, I guess, among some of these groups, and they still have a lot of people think these vehicular cyclists that oppose bike infrastructure have a bigger sort of voice than the average cyclist and sort of outweigh their voice at sometimes because it gives politicians in some cases an excuse to do nothing, you know, it's easier to do nothing to approve nothing to improve cycling conditions than to take action, you know, to take a risk. And that's been sort of a problem in Cleveland. From what I understand, we had some prominent vehicular cyclists that opposed bike infrastructure, and it prevented the city from improving the infrastructure. And, you know, we haven't developed the way like a Portland has as a result.
And we'll see how it goes here in Cleveland. And we'll see how it goes in Somerville. It'll be a nice test of whether these bike lanes get through legislature and then get used. And, I mean, I'd like to see it happening in more places than just New York and Portland.
Right. Actually, I wanted to mention there's been a lot of progress on that front with these protected bikeways. The Green Lane Project, which is a project of Bikes Belong, reported that the number of protected bike lanes doubled last year. Almost doubled. There was only 62 in 2011, and those had been built, you know, that's all we had for decades. And now we have 102.
Wow.
And they think by the end of this year, there'll be another 100. And 32 cities have these now. We don't have any really in Cleveland, and our traffic engineering department, unfortunately, adheres to some what I think are rather dated transportation guides from AASHTO that still list these treatments as experimental. But, 32 cities around the country, especially the more progressive cities, are embracing this infrastructure and seeing a lot of positive results.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me about your blogging with Streets Blog and the different articles you're writing and the different topics that you cover. It is streetsblog.org and rustwire.com. Angie Schmidt, thank you so much for talking to me this evening.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye. Angie Schmidt joined us from the west side of Cleveland, the Detroit Shoreway area. So that wraps the show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. And by all means, leave us a message on Facebook. Put a question out there and I'll see if I can answer it for you. Hope to see you back here same time next week. If you can get some dry and clear weather, go out for a ride. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.